Welcome back, folks. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You're about to hear a segment from our archives. It was a discussion that I hosted at the Baltimore Ethical Society last April. We look at the Baltimore uprising and the city's future. It was a fascinating conversation. Hope you enjoy the conversation. They did. We all did back then as well. So tomorrow is the anniversary, as you know, of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And when that assassination occurred, it was supposed to be a single man doing it. Most of us don't think that was the way it really happened, but however it happened, that was the day King was taken from us. And then in Baltimore in 1968, after King was assassinated, there were demonstrations. People were marching very peacefully. And then things erupted on Gay Street. And when things erupted on Gay Street, an entire rebellion happened. Now, I don't know how many of you remember that. Most of you, many of you are not old enough to remember that. Some of you are, but in 1968, what happened here in Baltimore last year, after Freddie Gray died, after being arrested on the 5th of April, deeply injured, and died a couple of weeks later, there was what we call the uprising, we're calling it. But let me give you a sense of the difference of what happened then, in terms of what we are facing today. And I was looking at the numbers earlier this morning. So it lasted for 8 days. 6 people were killed. 700 people were injured, many by police bullets. 5,800 people had been arrested. 10,000 businesses were damaged. And at that point in those days, $12 million worth of damage in the city. And it began the end of many things in the city. It was the opening and it was the ending when we think about where we are today. It was the opening because segregation just ended. 1964, legally, ended in the state of Maryland. And many of us went to jail to make that happen. But it was also the beginning of the end of industry in this community. The industrialization began at that period. So if you went in the black community, it was a very different place than today. Because of segregation, classes of people who could be a doctor living in one corner, a steel worker living in the middle of the block, a sanitation worker living around the corner, an Arab living across the street, cab driver living around the corner. It was a multi-class community and whole. I mean, one of the things that every time I drive around the city and see these vacant, empty houses and see the death in these neighborhoods, the way this looks like death, looks abandoned, looks like Dresden after World War II, which is what Eddie Conway described it as. But Eddie Conway was a Black Panther, a dear friend of mine, got out of prison after 43 years. One of the things that struck him was how the city looked. He said, I felt like I was driving home through a war zone. I felt like it looked like World War II in Germany. And that's what it feels like to people living inside. But in 1968, all those empty houses were filled with people. All those empty houses were filled with families, mothers and fathers and children, grandparents living together in community. It was a very different place. Was it hard? Yes. Was segregation abysmal and horrible? Yes. Was racism deep? Was the police department brutal in the black world in Baltimore? Yes. But it was a community, and there was a lot of power in that community. And so when you think about what had just happened in Sandtown, a little sidebar here. Sandtown's an old, old community. Back in the early 1900s, Sandtown was a place you wanted to live. It overlooked the river flowing into the Gwynns Falls. And it was sold that way to people. Come, buy your house, look over the river. On the heights of Baltimore, look down. So Sandtown, and when I was a kid, Sandtown, I used to run through the streets of Sandtown as a little boy, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. It was a tough working class neighborhood, but nothing like it is today. There were no abandoned homes. You had to be able to fight every once in a while. That happened to you, but it was a different place. So what we have now, think about what happened to Freddie Gray when he walked out that morning and saw those police a year ago and ran because he didn't know what it would mean to have a confrontation with these police. Does that mean I'm going to go back to jail? I don't feel like going back to jail. It's a nice day. I just was on my way to buy ice cream for these kids, which some of the little kids who knew him, that he would come every day and take them out to get an ice cream, take kids to dinner, do things for young people in the neighborhood, because he had this heart, as his family would say, this open heart for his community, for his people, for children in his community. So he ran. And the neighborhood he ran through, how many of you know the neighborhood well, have been through Sandtown? Sandtown is a neighborhood that has the longest commute distance of any neighborhood in Baltimore to get to work. But someone living in Sandtown, say to get to Towson, takes 2.5 to 3 hours every day to get from their house to a job in Towson. It has more abandoned houses per capita than almost every other neighborhood in Baltimore. Unemployment is one of the highest in the city. It has the largest percentage of ex-felons inside the neighborhood. It's a devastated neighborhood. So what happened after 68, where this is connected, is that was a time when people had jobs. There was unemployment, sure, but most people had work. Some people worked in the steel mill, maybe you worked in the box factory. There's my friend in Sandtown, Billy Bull's family. His mom, his dad worked in the box factory, his mom was a domestic. They both worked. They were both home with him and his brothers and sisters. Sandtown was a tough but very different place. So he ran, because he didn't want to get arrested again, Freddie Gray. And this happens every day in this city, what happened to Freddie Gray. People don't necessarily die, but this happens every day. When I think about that, and I think about places like the Ethnoculture Society, it's an appropriate place to kind of really wrestle with this, that Freddie Gray and all the Freddie Grays around him every day, and Frederica Gray, which happens to be his sister's name, his twin, they're confronted by police almost on a daily basis. There's a group called No Boundaries. Anybody heard of that group? And so it's a group of West Side neighborhoods that have come together. They put out this report, and they were on my show not long ago with their report. And this report went beyond talking about death at the hands of police or death at the hands of fellow citizens in their neighborhoods, but talked about what it was like to live in those neighborhoods. They interviewed 500 people in this report. And what was so stunning is the physical and verbal abuse that people in poor black communities face every day from the city police. The physical and verbal abuse, the disrespect, the lack of connection to the community. That to me is the single biggest issue. Police killings happen sometimes, and they're horrendous and have to be dealt with. Killings happen every day, and shootings happen every day in the city. They have to be addressed. But to live in a world where you don't know who to turn to, because you don't know who might be your friend in that uniform and who might just abuse you, belittle you, confront you, make you feel less than a human being. So you have two corners in your neighborhood sometimes. You walk out the door, the guys are slinging drugs in the corner, and the guys in those police cars are slinging abuse towards you. You don't call them when things go wrong because you know they can't do anything or won't do anything. But you take care of it yourself. And just think about this another piece of statistic that we use all the time on our program. We have 620,000 people in the city, 2,000 people in the city. 132,000 families. 91,000 households in Baltimore City. 91,000 households do not know if they can meet their rent payment, pay their gas and electric bill, buy food, or what they need every month. 91,000 households. So multiply that by 2, 3, 4, whatever that number might be. Is that a third to a half or more of the city of Baltimore? Nobody's ever really done that study to know the exact numbers. But we know the number of households. Housing did that for us. So we have to think about what that means for the city, about what we have to change and how we have to change it. We did a show the other day about, it's called Light City, which I think was a great idea. I mean, I think bringing the arts to the world and opening that stuff up is really important. But why does Light City and everything we do in this city happen in this corridor? Everything that's beautiful happens in this corridor. It happens from Hopkins University down to the harbor, a little bit over to the east, a little bit over to the west, and that's where they happen. So when we had the artists on our show, one group of the artists, Paul Rucker, I don't know if you know his work, Paul Rucker had an exhibit at the BMA. He's a cellist, and he's an artist from Seattle, was brought here to go come to word of my, to teach at MICA. He's now Creative Alliance, black man in his 40s. Does these incredible exhibits. He did one where he showed where slavery existed and where most of the prison populations exist, and this incredible map, and he does all these other beautiful kind of pieces of work. Very powerful. What he did was, he made these lamps that had 19th century newspapers in them, all along Pratt Street and up and around. And these were all places where slaves were sold, and the ads in the Sun papers for their being sold were there. So that was his exhibit. And then Mina Chung and her husband, Gabe, who produced this piece called Diamonds, and it had to do with the diamonds that supported capitalism in capital, these beautiful white lights that turned to blue lights, because the most prevalent lights in Baltimore are not street lights, but blue lights, which are the police lights to shine down where you see things in the city, to watch the city. So we were talking about, and these were very important exhibits, I thought, and it was a great festival. But my question to the festival was, so why didn't the festival light up Rose and Ashland? Why didn't it light up Pennsylvania North? Why didn't it light up Liberty Heights and Garrison? Why didn't it light up Cherry Hill? Why didn't it light up Brooklyn? Why didn't we go into the communities and bring people out to create the art that would light up their own communities and tell the story they wanted to tell? Why didn't it get people out of their comfort zone here in Central City to go to Cherry Hill to see the lights they could have put up? So those are the questions I always ask. Because whenever we have a policy in the city, as far as I'm concerned, and the way we approach our work on the air, if that work doesn't in some way affect the lives of the hundreds of thousands of people in this city who are poor, working class, and black, then they're not worth doing. They're not worth doing. And I think that's how we have to think about the future of our city, about where we're going, what we want to do in this town, how we're going to change this place. The energy of people in this room is probably the energy that changes that. You know, I really do believe, maybe a little digression, I keep thinking about Felix Adler since I was thinking about this yesterday in writing and reading some of his history again and thinking about who he was. And I'm sure if Felix Adler was alive today, he'd be supporting Black Lives Matter. And when you think of the people who came through ethical culture all these years, there are people who have fought racism in this country, fought for a more class equality in this country. Felix Adler was a socialist, made no bones about it. Something about Jews and socialists, I wonder what that's about. Some guys running for president now, I think, like that. But I think that stuff is, there are connections here. And those historical connections are important because they help us think about where we are now and where we might go and where the future will take us. So when you think about the city, how do we change things? How do we make things so that the city grows up together and lives together? That's what we have to think about. And that's part of what I think our job in the radio and the media is. So it's not to ask the simple questions. What I want to know is, if we're going to build these hotels downtown and all these places downtown, so how many people in those hotels live here in Baltimore, in black neighborhoods, in poor black neighborhoods, and are getting those jobs? That's what I want to know. Why don't we start workers' cooperatives throughout this city with the help of the government, those institutions, University of Maryland, Hopkins, whatever. How many of you know about the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland? Okay. So in Cleveland, there's a group at University of Maryland College Park called the Democracy Collaborative. They do some really interesting work. Not here in Baltimore. We brought them up to Baltimore a few times. We're going to get them here more. But in Cleveland, they negotiated with the equivalent to Johns Hopkins Hospital or University of Maryland Hospital. And these workers started a co-op. And that co-op does all the laundry for that hospital. So that the workers in that who do this co-op own the place collectively. They were able to, because they started a business, build a LEEDS quality facility to do all the laundry. They now employ over 150 people who own the business. Those workers who have lived in that company and work in that company for 3 years or longer, get dividends at the end of the year. Last year was $65,000 a person. That changes the nature of communities. That changes the nature of families. That keeps people together. That keeps people out of jail. That's one way. Another way is to change the way our criminal justice system functions. We'd be here all day if I started down that road. But, so we have to think differently. There should be co-ops all over this city. The men and women who clean the stadiums and get paid $9, $10, $11 an hour, if that, for cleaning our puke in those bathrooms. Why shouldn't they have a co-op where they make a decent wage for doing that job that puts black and Latino and white workers who work together in those stadiums together? Workers' co-ops is one of the ways we have to think about how you build a different future. Why don't we have bonds in the city? We have bonds that can give money to the BMA and to Walters. And I love the BMA and I love the Walters. I love those institutions. I love all of our institutions. They're important. I'm glad we have them. But A, if we can have a bond for the BMA and a bond for our theaters, why don't we have a bond that puts money into arena players? Where's their money? Right? Or UB Blake. Where's the money for them? If we can float bonds to give a TIF to Kevin Plank, then we can float a bond to build houses for poor people that they own and run themselves, that also get hired to help build the houses they live in, that put people to work. We have to think in different ways if we're going to build a different society. And Baltimore can be that place. We have an incredible history. We are the most southern northern city and the most northern southern city. But we are. Think about it. After New York City, Baltimore was the largest port of entry for European immigrants in the early 20th century. That's how my grandparents, my father's parents, got here. It was also where, also had the largest free black population of any city in America before the Civil War. The state had the largest free black population of any state before the Civil War. We were talking this morning about it on this day of May 19th in 1870, Baltimore had the largest celebration for the 15th Amendment of any place in the country. The largest. In Mount Vernon. We have all that history together, but we're also the most segregated city in the country. April 11th, did I have that day right? It's April, so it's not the 11th, I'm sorry. But it is 1911, I know that. Baltimore, we were joking when we were showing the book. Baltimore's famous for its firsts. I was a little boy, there was a book of Baltimore firsts. It's a big deal. But so Baltimore has lots of firsts. We're also the first city to redline. We are the originators of the red line. The housing ordinance of 1911, Mayor Maloof, I believe I'm right about that. Maloof. Signed this order that segregated housing in Baltimore legally. And even though it was taken to court and challenged and overturned, cities across America took that law and began implementing civil laws around the country. So we have a real mixed bag in this town. But that mixed bag can work to our benefit. We are a hyper-segregated city, but we're also a city that can have the hope because we can change things given the nature of who we are in this town. I believe that. There's a lot of people of goodwill, like the people in this room and people across this city. We have to change how we do the work we do. Just to let you all know, the 13th of this month, at Douglas Memorial Church, Eddie Conway, the former Black Panther, and I, who now works in Real News, and I are going to be moderating a panel with the communities of ex-felons who have just got the right to vote for the mayoral candidates. So we're bringing together poor people's activist group organizations, ex-felons organizations together to address the mayor, people who are going to become mayor on that day. At Douglas Memorial, you're all invited to come check that out, because that's where the movement gets started. It's when the Ethnoculture Society moves over and works with no boundaries and begins to work together across these class and racial lines, religious lines, and pull ourselves together to rebuild something no matter who becomes mayor. despite who becomes mayor. It's to push who becomes the next mayor. And that's what we have to do. And so, let me just conclude this way, that the way I see this for me, for the Mark Steiner Show, for our Center for Emerging Media, is that we have to push the envelope. I spent a long time, the last 23 years, in public radio. And when I first started out, I learned something about how you have to approach your work. And approaching that, and because I was, the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health asked me to go with them, so I went with them to this reservation in Wisconsin, Ojibwe Reservation. And this woman there did this film. She asked everybody in the room, what is communication? And I just, this was my third radio show. What is communication? And almost every white and black person in the room said something very long. I mean, a long answer. Dialogue, getting to know one another, hearing people. Almost every native person in the room said one word. One word. Listening. That struck me so deep. Listening. So that changed a lot of who I was at that moment, because I was, you know, came in as a pretty radical guy and very combative, not that I still can be that way, but then understanding that you listen. And to listen, if you do that right, that means no matter who you talk to, there's some truth in what they have to say. You talk to a Donald Trump supporter, there's some truth in what that person has to say. You have to hear that. And so I say that because we have to begin hearing each other in this city in ways, in non-threatening places, to get together and hear what other people are saying, what people want. It's not what the mayor wants for Sandtown, it's what Sandtown wants for itself. That's what's critical. So we have to hear that. We have to hear each other if we're going to build something new to change the city. And I really do believe we can do it. It can take a while, but we have the kernel here. It's all over this town. So I just leave you just one thought. The one thought is that I would really hope, and maybe you're already doing this, and if you are, and I hope so, but that is to reach out to groups like No Boundaries. Reach out to groups like the people who, the ex-felon groups that are happening in Gilmore and McCullough Homes. Reach out to the folks who are working around housing as a right. And really make that connection. And make that connection to help unify a movement in the city to build the kind of communities that we all want to have. And I think that when you think about the roots of ethical culture, one of the things that motivated Felix Adler, well, some of the many people around him, and the people who came after him, Florence Greene and all the rest, was seeing what the abject poverty of New York meant, and saying we can't abide that, and we can't accept that, and that has to change. So the very heart and essence of this society, of ethical culture in this country, was radical social change. It was radical social change at the heart of Felix Adler's beliefs and work. Crossing racial lines and the humanist philosophy that we all know about in this room. To think about the roots, that's why history is so important, the roots of who we are, the roots of who you are as ethical culturalists, means that on that you build the future of Baltimore. That's your role. Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.